Hello, welcome to your week with Life Matters here on ABCRN. Natasha Mitchell, very pleased to be with you. How was your weekend? Perhaps it was a big one. Your family might have gathered for Mother's Day. I will admit, one pretty sickly, sweet alcoholic cider yesterday afternoon, and that was about enough for me. And we're considering our changing relationship with alcohol on the program today because it is changing, striking new data. And a leader in the field is going to join us. We're going to take some of your calls too on how you think your relationship with alcohol has changed, whether your kids relate to it differently. Political economist Elizabeth Hill will join us later as well. She's co-convener of the Work and Family Policy Roundtable. What will the government's proposed changes to childcare payments mean for you if they get through? And also, who gives a crap? No, I'm not being rude. That's the name of a novel social enterprise. CEO Simon Griffiths will be popping in on the imperative for businesses to innovate or die. And ethics, of course, are at the heart of social enterprises. And on Friday, Labor law specialist Tess Hardy was effectively demanding that ethics be at the heart of the supermarket system in Australia after shocking revelations on Four Corners that many migrant workers in the fruit and veg sector are being subjected to slave-like conditions. And here are some of your calls in response to our conversation.
I've been working in food growing in Australia since 1999, and I'm mildly amused by all those people who all of a sudden discover this issue. This has been going on for as long as I've worked here. It's not a new problem, and it's close to being systematic. And don't tell me that the growers aren't aware of it. When you get 10 people to work for you for 10 hours and the bill is $1,800, you know that you're paying them below minimum wage.
Hi, Lee Jenkins in Adelaide. I can't believe the lady from the university turned around and said that we might have to have higher prices to sort out the fruit pickers. Now, the fruit pickers, if they were getting paid normal, proper rate, they'd be, everything would be okay. But because the greedy employment agencies that are bringing them in, they're the ones who are stealing the money. So why do we have to pay for more expensive fruit? That just doesn't fit the bill.
Hi, my name's Margaret and I live in Canberra. There has been talk about the ability of the supermarkets to cancel contracts if they find things being done unethically. Well, I think the supermarkets themselves are completely unethical in the way they squeeze producers down to the bone to find any way they can to reduce their costs because of the impossibly low prices that the supermarkets are demanding from these growers so they can brag about how they're having such cheap or prices so down.
Yes, thank you, Margaret. And that issue of where we buy our food, where our food comes from, always gets you talking. And what a response also to our discussion on Friday about the choice to be child-free, to not have children. Really interesting discussion is underway on our Facebook page and our website, so I urge you to go and be part of that. Here are some of your calls in response to that conversation.
My name is Connie. I work in loss and grief, and there is nothing more devastating for people who want children and cannot have them. But I am child-free by choice, and listening to today's show was just amazing, all of the shares. My ex-husband and I chose not to have children, and my in-laws reacted as if we had actually shot a child. Because some of my in-laws had to work very hard with IVF to have children of their own, they just thought it was absolutely the equivalent of murdering a child not to have a child. And the stigma and the judgment that was made against us for making the decision was horrific.
Oh, hi, I've been listening to the program on women and couples that decide or cannot have children and like to give a male perspective, I guess. My wife and I met when I was in my mid-30s and she was a bit younger and we thought we'd like to enjoy each other's company a bit more before we had kids. We gave ourselves a couple of years and then thought, right, we'll have some kids now. For whatever reason, it didn't happen. People sometimes were aghast that we didn't have kids and we were selfish or whatever. And my response was simply that, well, and my wife's response, I might add, was that, well, you know, her eggs are bad, my sperm want to come backwards.
I was just going to say that I really respect the choice not to have children. However, I am noting that maybe it's often some of the really good thinkers and conscious beings that are choosing not to have children, and maybe they're the ones that we should be having more of on this planet, and maybe they're the ones that should be having kids. We need more thinkers and more people who think about the system and will question their reality. Thank you.
Interesting perspective, that one, possibly controversial. And our listener line for your comments throughout the show, 24 hours a day, in fact, it's open, 02 833 1430. That's 02 833 1430, or you can tweet us at RN Life Matters. Stay with us. Australian alcohol consumption at a 50-year low. That was the headline bouncing around last week. And at a glance, that is indeed what the latest figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics reveal. Over the last year, Australians 15 years and over bought enough grog to consume roughly 2 standard drinks per day each, the lowest level of consumption since the early 1960s, apparently. But as we're about to hear, there may be more to this story and these figures. It might surprise you to learn who is really driving down the consumption figures. And I'd like to hear from you this morning. When it comes to our drinking habits, your drinking habits, have they changed over time? I know they certainly have for me. What have you noticed between generations in your family? We're particularly interested to know. How are you and those around you consuming alcohol differently? What you drink, where you get it from, how you do it? Has your relationship to alcohol changed over time? What about the role that it's played in your life? What have you noticed? Give us a call right now, 1300 225 576. That's 1300-CALL-RN. Or you can text us 0418 226 576 or tweet us at RN Life Matters. Now, here's what people in and around Haymarket told RN's Pip Rasmussen.
I don't drink at all. I don't drink at all. People are becoming more aware of, like, the consequences of drinking, yeah. Like, there's no benefits in it because, like, alcohol, it kind of stuffs up your whole, like, your mentalities. You can't really train at your peak because your body's not as healthy as it possibly can be.
Yeah, I stopped drinking. I got into fitness and I can't stay fit and drink. I know amongst my friends, most of them used to be heavy drinkers and now they don't really drink anymore.
I like to drink to have fun, but not to get smashed. But yeah, people are replacing it with harder drugs, finding different ways to party.
These new figures that are showing in Australia, drinking is at a 50-year low.
I know, the beer's dropped down by such a large percentage of normal people drinking beer that I think it's a good thing for Australia. I think people are more concerned about their own health now and well-being.
Are you sure that's right?
What do you think people are doing instead of drinking now?
Smoking weed, doing other drugs.
What are your drinking habits?
I've actually stopped drinking. I've stopped clubbing as well. I'm pretty lightweight now.
Yeah, I'm probably more of a binge drinker, like weekends.
After seeing what my dad can drink and our age, I think we outdo him, his generation.
What are your drinking habits?
When I don't have work in uni, they get a bit out of hand because I work in a bar, so it gets a bit hard, but a couple of times a week.
We just hang out with friends, normally in the day. We're grandmas because we're shift workers, so we go to bed early.
It's a lot more expensive now these days, especially with, you know, having uni and a job. We don't get enough money to spend it all on alcohol. This is much more important stuff, so.
And if you were to replace drinking with something else, do you do that at all?
Probably PlayStation.
I have no idea why the drinking's going down in Australia. It could be also because less people are drinking beer now. Maybe there's just more awareness around in the media now, more drink driving ads.
Yeah, maybe people are getting more aware about, like, the risks of drinking, I guess.
It doesn't surprise me that people are drinking less beer, but it does surprise me that people are drinking less.
What are your drinking habits then?
Wine, generally.
What do you think people are doing that is reducing drinking levels in Australia?
I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe there's less binge drinking, or maybe people aren't going to pubs as much. Maybe it's small bars. I don't know. I'm surprised.
It's Pip Rasmussen on the streets asking people about how their relationship to alcohol has changed. Alcohol consumption in Australia at a 50-year low. I wonder if that figure surprises you. Does it reflect your own drinking habits? 1300 225 576. Join us. Be part of the conversation. 1300-CALL-RN. Joining us this morning is Mike Daube. He's Professor of Health Policy at Curtin University and Director of Public Health, the Public Health Advocacy Institute, and the McCusker Centre for Action on Alcohol and Youth. He's also been Director General of Health for Western Australia. This is an issue that he cares about a lot. Good morning to you, Mike.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us in the Perth studios. Before we get to the latest picture, how have our drinking habits tracked over the past several decades? If I can put it crudely, when were we at our drunkest as a nation?
Well, look, good question.
Can I ask that question?
Probably the 70s, and consumption started going up in the 60s, but it started declining in the 70s. So maybe unexpectedly, it started going down during the Whitlam and Kerr eras, not during the Bob Hawke era as Prime Minister. And since then, a few ups and downs. For example, it went up again during the mid 2000s for a bit, and then declining. So it's gradually been going down. But of course, that masks a whole range of other trends, as in fact some of the people who spoke to you earlier said. It masks what we're drinking, this big switch from beer to wine. Mm. It masks things like the aging population, because older people inevitably drink less. What it masks too is that the harms of alcohol are still massive. We're still up in the Alps, not at Kosciuszko. It masks that we're still one of the higher drinking OECD countries, a really important issue. So whole range of, it even masks where we're drinking, because we buy our alcohol now primarily from bottle shops, not from hotels. So a whole lot of fascinating trends. But crucially, one of the things that concerns me that it masks is that we're seeing, particularly in kids, a sort of two-tier trend, which is more people being sensible, but those who drink, drinking more harmfully.
So you're not necessarily optimistic about this figure of Australian alcohol consumption at a 50-year low?
Look, I think you have to be encouraged by positive trends. And I need to make it clear, Natasha, that the aim of people in health isn't that nobody drinks. It's not to get rid of alcohol. It's to have sensible people drinking sensibly, and young people in particular being sensible or not drinking. But I think there are some encouraging trends, and we need to pursue those. And also, I think we need to say, look, some of the publicity, the education, the public health campaigns, as again one of your interviewees said, I think those are starting to have some impact.
Mm, that's interesting. So let's break it down further in terms of these latest ABS stats. Is there any given group of people that are drinking significantly less?
Well, as in an ageing population, and we are an ageing population, older people inevitably do drink less. I think the bulk of the concern has to be about young people up to the age of about 30. That's where the bulk of the drinking goes on. And the bulk of the concern has to be about those who drink harmfully. And that's those, and particularly, as I said, younger people, those who drinking more harmfully. But let's not forget that even people who regularly don't drink harmfully, even amongst those, if they have a few too many, or if they drink and then get into their cars and drive, then they're lethal, even if they're not regular drinkers.
Yes, but these stats do suggest, and let's come then to that two-tier trend that you alluded to in young people. At least a subset of young people are drinking significantly less, it would seem.
Yep, and I think that's really very encouraging indeed. More young people being sensible about alcohol use. And interestingly,
is it being sensible, or is it shifting priorities? I'm just wondering what's at the heart of that trend.
A range of issues, Natasha. And I think we need to look at what's happening in other areas too. You know, we've seen a dramatic decline in young people smoking. We're seeing some, actually, despite some of the media around specific drugs, we're seeing some encouraging trends among some forms of drug use. So I think we may be seeing generations that are responding to the public education, responding to the media. And of course, and again, one of your interviews alluded to this, there may be other things to do. They don't go to the pub so much. They may be on their screens, using social media. So some fascinating trends that are still to be unpacked. But really important, I think, to be positive, particularly about the young people who are, a lot of them, I think, by design, trying to do the right thing.
Mm. Let's take a couple of calls in the mix. Catherine in Sydney, good morning to you.
Hi.
This is very personal for you.
It is. Look, I'm an alcoholic. Had a couple of wines already this morning. I think the thing that worries me is that, you know, you can buy alcohol from 8 o'clock in the morning. You can get 4 litres of wine for under $9 at certain retail shops. And, you know, I've been through detox and rehab a couple of times. And, you know, I've been through the methadone program, haven't touched any hard drugs for about 25 years. But alcohol's hard because it's legally available.
It's so available. Yep.
And yep. I don't go out. I don't go out to pubs. I stay at home and drink. And it's something for me, I'm classed as a top-up drunk. So, you know, I've never been in trouble with the law, but I have to have something on a constant basis. But alcohol's so easily available. And, you know, I was even surprised myself when I found that, you know, things like, you know, the big retail where they've got their own alcohol supplies there, you know, from 8 o'clock in the morning you can buy it.
Catherine, thank you, and I hope you get some support if you need it. Thank you.
I'm fine, don't worry, thank you.
I do worry, you see.
I'm all right. Thank you, guys. I love Radio National, so thank you.
And
bye.
We really love getting your call this morning, because Mike Daube, where people are buying alcohol is reflected in these stats.
Absolutely. And look, thanks very much to Catherine for that call. Really important issues she raises. Alcohol is incredibly accessible, and particularly now that we're seeing the march of the bottle shops, and those are essentially controlled by the big chains, Woolworths and Coles West Farmers. Alcohol is incredibly accessible, and a particular concern too, it's accessible to children and young people. A recent paper in one of the major journals showed that about at least half of young people say they find it easy to buy alcohol underage. So we've got problems of access, we've got problems of massive promotion of alcohol, because the drinks industry isn't taking this lying down. You know, they want people to drink as much as possible, and you see huge promotion for beer and other products. So we've got all of these issues at play. And as Catherine pointed out, we have the problem of price. There's a thing called the wine equalization tax, which in some ways is wonderfully complex, but in other ways is incredibly simple, that wine can be sold dirt cheap. Cask wine, you can get it at $2 a litre, and that's something that I hope the Treasurer changes in the coming budget, because it's just a nonsense that we should allow alcohol to be sold so dirt cheap. It's an invitation to young people, disadvantaged people, to drink to get drunk.
Has that changed? Has the cost of alcohol significantly changed?
Well, I think, you know, one of the
You could always get cheap plonk.
You could always get cheap plonk, but the wine equalisation tax makes it incredibly cheap, particularly in relation to other products. So our current alcohol tax system was described by the Henry Review as incoherent, and it sure is. It's a real dog's breakfast. We need a sensible alcohol tax system. What we also need, incidentally, is the government to put some of the billions it gets from alcohol revenue back into trying to do something about those problems. And incidentally, Natasha, I think one thing that sort of we need to think about too, underpinning this issue of alcohol trends, is that the last few years have been pretty tough for our economy, and inevitably people will be drinking a bit less when times are hard.
Okay, Mike Daube is with us this morning. Professor Mike Daube, he is Professor of Health Policy at Curtin University, Director of the Public Health Advocacy Institute and the McCusker Centre for Action on Alcohol and Youth. And we're talking about our changing relationship to alcohol off the back of some Australian Bureau of Statistics stats suggesting alcohol consumption in Australia is at a 50-year low. But as Mike suggested, that masks all sorts of interesting shifts and trends that are occurring in terms of our relationship to alcohol. And we're taking your calls too, 1300 22 55 76. That's 1300 call RN. Michael in Melbourne, good morning to you. You'd like to ask about what we're drinking.
Right. Well, I was actually wondering about whether those statistics you guys are using factor in home brewing, because I actually make my own beer. I make about 20 litres a month. using recycled bottles, and I share it with my friends. And I actually know quite a few people who are making their own beer now because the price is so high at the bottle shops. So I was just curious about that.
Yeah, I'll come back to Mike Daube on that. Mike, are these only just what's sold over the counter, these stats?
This is just what's sold over the counter.
Can't really track homebrew, can you?
Yeah, sorry, or to be more precise, information that's available to the government and so on. So it doesn't cover that. And you know, there is a perception that for various reasons the ABS figures are a bit of an underestimate, but the trends will probably be pretty right.
Okay, thanks very much, Mike.
Thank you.
For the call. And we've got Barbara, I think, in Sydney. Good morning to you.
Morning, Natasha. Love your show,
Thank
as
you.
Usual.
Thank you.
I just want to say, remember when we watched films or television series, people smoke cigarettes? That's all gone. Now I've noticed people are drinking wine. It's just an observation.
Yes.
And especially in television series, but also film. So if children see that, or young people, you know, it's just a thought.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Right.
Mike, yep. This is an issue, isn't it? Because you're suggesting that public health campaigns around drinking have cut through with young people. I'd be interested to understand the evidence for that, or whether other things are affecting why young people's drinking habits are shifting and, in fact, reducing. But you know, they get messages from so many other directions.
Well, that's right. And, of course, there are a range of issues for any trends in this area. But our last caller was spot on. You know, there's heaps of evidence now from the tobacco area that the tobacco companies used to pay huge sums of money for what's called product placement in films. And who knows if the same kind of thing is going on with alcohol products. At least we do know that kind of thing does go on. And of course, young people are being exposed to just enormous levels of alcohol promotion through, particularly through things like sports sponsorship, but also through social media. And again, there's an onus, I think, on governments, and particularly the federal government, to reduce the level of alcohol promotion to which kids are exposed. Anybody who watches, it can be AFL, it can be rugby league, where state of origin is just one beer brand against another beer brand. The alcohol companies are massively into use of social media, which is where young people, children and young people live and breathe. So I think this is an area that governments need to take action on. And on that one, I'm very pessimistic. It's a global drinks industry. It's enormously powerful. And I don't think that governments are going to do much about it.
Let's come to Greg in Brisbane, because you work as a retailer of alcohol, I'm assuming, Greg?
Correct.
So what's your position and your concern here on, I mean, what's been raised here is that alcohol is very easy to get, it's very cheap, and that is exacerbating the problem of problematic drinking.
From my experience, what happens is that we are under tighter and tighter controls. It's the tightest control I've ever seen. And, you know, when I was young, you know, before I turned 18, it was so easy for me to actually get into a bottle shop and get alcohol, far easier than somebody today. I check for people if they look 25, and some people look 30, and I still need to ask them for ID and check their ID, and we have very strict controls.
So what do you mean by very strict, the tightest controls of all? How is it tighter?
Well, I need to write down everybody. I need to write down the year of birth of everybody that comes through my register. So I need to say whether they were, what year they were born in.
Not every customer. Only those that you question in terms of their
age. Exactly. Exactly. And then at the end of the day, I need to fill out a book. That liquor licensing can come and look at any stage for every register that I have that says that I have checked these IDs and that there are issues or no issues.
Okay.
And any issues then reported.
I'll thank you very much for the call, Greg, and I'll come back to Mike on that in just a minute. I'll take another call from Bruce in Gladstone. Good morning, Bruce. You'd like to make a point about the price of alcohol.
Yes, Natasha Wood. Firstly, I'd like to say I sympathise I feel for Catherine, your caller earlier. It nearly made me cry, actually, to hear her say that she's already had a couple of wines at this time of day. That was so tragic. And I've been in business with an alcoholic, so I know the ramifications of alcoholism. However, I don't think putting the price of alcohol up across the board is fair to the rest of us who are responsible drinkers. I mean, why should we pay the price for the minority who obviously can't handle their alcohol consumption? And sympathising also with your previous caller there about having to fill in a register. I've had three liquor licences over the past 10 years, and the things you have to do to comply, because people are irresponsible, I don't think it's anything to do with the legislation, I don't think it's anything to do with alcohol itself. It obviously comes down to self-control. And the burden that the lack of self-control puts on the industry is enormous.
Look, thank you very much for the call, Bruce. Jack in Melbourne, you'd like to make a point too, just a brief one.
Oh, yeah, look, I lost control of my drinking. It's nice that Bruce is all about self-control. I lost control of my drinking about 15 years ago. I'd been, you know, often a heavy drinker, then I became a heavy daily drinker. And my life was just going, you know, down the toilet. It was just terrible. I couldn't go a day without a drink. When I wasn't having a drink, if I tried to go a day without a drink, I'd just obsess about having a drink. And what I did was I got myself down to an AA meeting. And AA is just magic. The only requirement for membership there is the desire to stop drinking. And all you've got to do, if you want to stop drinking, if you're sick of your drinking, is to go to meetings and do what they suggest. And people think it's for, you know, old and down and outs and so on. The place is just full of vibrant young people who I think seem to have a problem earlier and earlier because they use drugs with it as well. I don't know. But the rooms are full of, you know, really fun people in their 20s and 30s. And 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, and we just mix in nicely. The rooms are full. We have activities afterwards. It takes about 12 months to get used to having fun without a drink, but it is just open there for everyone. And all you got to do if you're sick of your drinking is to ring up the AA number in your capital city or look up the website, get to a meeting, and your life can begin all over. It's a much better life than those of those who, like me, were a slave to the stuff. And when you lose self-control, you don't get it back.
Jack, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate that one. Jack, singing the praises of AA and the impact it's had on his life. Mark Daub, finally back to you. The Alcohol Liquor Stores Association has said that the figures that have been released show that Australians are choosing quality over quantity, that we're, quote, drinking to success, not to excess. They've also said the stats, quote, demonstrate how misleading the temperance and anti-alcohol advocacy industry are when they continue to claim that there is an alcohol epidemic.
Okay, let's take three quick things. First, the
just
callers.
Just briefly, if we can.
Yeah, briefly. Of course, there are some retailers who are responsible about selling alcohol, particularly to kids, but a lot of them aren't, and governments need to act on that. Second, I don't know who the Liquor Stores Association are talking about when they talk about temperance and so on. That's just nonsense. The concern is to reduce the harms caused by alcohol. We are still a heavy drinking country by world standards. So let's be positive about some of the positive trends, but let's also recognise that we've still got a mountain to climb. There are still massive harms out there. They're still being seen in our emergency departments. We've still got kids starting to drink at early ages, and those are the areas where we need action through price, and raising the price of dirt cheap wine doesn't harm the normal drinker. We need action on price and tax. We need curbs on alcohol promotion. We need proper controls on access. And as you saw in New South Wales, when you have that with the lockouts, for example, you get reductions in harms, and we need strong public education. So we know what to do so we can have a sensible community of sensible people, those who want to drink, drinking sensibly, and we still have all those huge harms in our community caused by alcohol. Let's not declare success when it doesn't exist.
A very strong statement from you, Mike Daub, and thank you. We might get you back on to talk about what they do in New Zealand in terms of minors accessing alcohol in liquor stores, which I thought was very interesting, but we haven't
got time to get to it.
Yeah, so let's follow up on that again. I think that was an interesting story to tell. Professor Mike Daub, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor of Health Policy at Curtin University and Director of the Public Health Advocacy Institute. And you can continue this conversation on our website or our Facebook page or indeed on Twitter at RN Life Matters or our listener feedback line, particularly if you're in WA, Northern Territory, South Australia. We'd love to hear from you. 02 8333 1430. That's 02 8333 1430. Well, it's budget week, federal budget. It's about to land. We're going to analyse it closely on Wednesday. But ahead of that, we want to talk about the slated childcare payment changes. That's coming up. Well, ahead of tomorrow night's budget, the government, as we've heard this morning on Breakfast and AM, has committed $3.5 billion in extra spending on childcare over 4 years, though the changes are dependent on the Senate giving a green light to cuts to existing family tax benefits. Treasurer Joe Hockey also announced that the government would no longer fund paid parental leave for mothers whose employer already paid as much or more than the government-funded scheme. So to weigh up the wins and losses so far for you, if you're a parent, we're joined this morning by Dr. Elizabeth Hill. She is a political economist at the University of Sydney. She's co-convener of the Work and Family Policy Roundtable, who have been tracking these issues over a decade now. Welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks so much, Natasha.
Now, so I think we should probably start with the paid parental leave scheme. Mm. Prime Minister Tony Abbott dropped his signature scheme, which many thought was overly generous. Treasurer Joe Hockey says people are double dipping and they're going to put a stop to that. Now, so this is about parents taking both their employer's paid parental scheme, but also taking advantage of the government scheme as well.
That's correct, Natasha. Look, the Treasurer's claim that mothers have been double dipping is quite outrageous. In fact, this was the way that the program was established. It followed the Productivity Commission's recommendation that the government institute a universal program and that where employers were already providing some paid parental leave, that they could actually take both on to extend the period of time that they would have paid while at home caring for their child.
But were they being paid both at the same time? So they were getting the minimum wage coverage with the government scheme and then also their full wage through some of their employer schemes?
No, they
schemes.
Would complete one scheme and then they would access, for example, the government scheme if they had their own employer
to
scheme.
To extend it to?
To extend it, to get closer to the recommended amount of time that you have at home with your baby of around 6 months. Now, this was part of the design and the architecture, and to say that women were double dipping is in fact, as I say, quite misplaced. Women were accessing the scheme as it was available to them. And the idea was that Australia was developing an iterative program that would increase the time that women had to be paid and stay at home with their babies. Now, in fact, women, I would argue, have been double-crossed by this kind of change in the policy framework, because we've seen a situation where the government went to the election with what was one of the world's most generous paid parental leave schemes. And of course, we know that there was a lot of political fallout from that. But now with yesterday's announcement, we've really gone right back to a very minimalist program.
Well, how do we compare internationally if that does get through?
We'll be towards the bottom. I mean, the good thing is that Australia now at least has an 18-week universal program.
At
minimum wage. We were one of only two countries that had no program in 2011. So that was a great step forward. So we have a very solid program. The idea is that we move towards providing paid care for up to 6 months for mothers to bond with their mother and to promote their own well-being and the well-being of the child. So this is a really, what we've seen yesterday, I think, with the combination of announcements, is a real realignment in Australia's approach to women's paid care and work participation, because we've got a rolling back of the paid parental scheme in terms of the amount of time that was paid, and we've got changes to the childcare funding. But what we've seen is an opening up of the gap between those two programs? Because ideally what you want is a program of paid parental leave that moves nicely into the capacity to take up childcare. By drawing this back, by drawing the paid parental leave back, we actually open up a time period where a lot of women won't have any form of care, and they won't have paid time to be caring themselves at home. For families that have to go back to work, that creates a real problem for them. And it also could have an adverse effect. The minister has said that childcare is all about workforce participation. But by rolling back the length of time that many have access to paid parental leave, it actually could undermine workforce participation and lead to disengagement.
Oh, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because the other, so people are calling this a very generous package. Mm. It is an improvement on what we have. There is a subset of people, though, who will be listening, mothers who are at home, who may be heavily disadvantaged by this announcement. Mm. And those are parents who are not working, not in the workforce. Mm. They're at home minding their kids. They've made that choice. Mm. Their households are over $65,000. Just remind us what these announcements say will happen to them. They're not going to get any childcare payments at all.
They're not going to get any publicly subsidised support for childcare. So they can still use it, but they won't be receiving public subsidy for that. Mm. I think
have to pay for it themselves.
They'll have to pay for it themselves.
So that's sending a clear message that you should not be a stay-at-home parent.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing. With the new funding approach, as the minister said, this is all about workforce participation. And I think there's a real problem here because yesterday, for all the talk, we didn't hear any talk about children's needs. And the thing about childcare is that it should be and needs to be, all the research on early childhood education and care tells us that it needs to be focused on children. It's for their development.
Well, we did hear this morning on Breakfast, though, with a leading figure in the childcare provision community, that in fact childcare is about focusing on children's needs. Yes, it advantages parents, but done well, this is an educational opportunity.
Absolutely, but when you tie the structure of public subsidy directly to women's, particularly workforce participation, you do undermine that somewhat. And also with the tightened up work test for those in households of 65,000 or under, it means that the children from households that actually stand to benefit the most from early childhood education and care, they are disadvantaged somewhat.
Just explain then, just for people who are tuning into all this for the first time, what are the key changes?
So for those families that do not pass the work test and earn less than $65,000 a year, they do have access to 12 hours of publicly subsidised care a week, or 24 hours a fortnight. That is less than what's currently available. And the research tells us very clearly that children from low-income households who tend to often experience other forms of disadvantage, they really require 2 to 3 days of early childhood education and care to really pull them along. And I think in the global context where there's a lot of talk at the moment by very mainstream economic institutions like the IMF about inequality, one thing we do know about early childhood education and care is that it is the most, probably, if not the most, one of the most effective policy interventions to address inequality. So I think from that point of view, we really need to be focusing the funding on children from at that lower end. Mm. The current program does have a safety net, but in a sense, there's also a potential for stigmatisation there of children. And the research shows very clearly that a universal approach to childcare, where everybody across the socioeconomic spectrum has buy-in, is the most effective way of really investing in children. And this is an investment in the future. You can actually create an economic argument very easily around this, around inequality and around the future. Workforce participation and productivity.
Just briefly and finally, so your suggestion is that the government's announcement yesterday does not reach out across the full spectrum of parents. I mean, isn't this about targeting those who most need childcare?
Absolutely. But there are structures within that do put extra pressure on those who would benefit most. So while it is a broad-based program, I think it's positive that there is some public subsidy for high-income families to get that buy-in, but we're seeing that tightening still at that bottom end, even though there's plenty of resources going there as well. So I just think that the research tells us that a universal system, like they've got in the UK, would work very well. And in fact, Australia, I think we need to remember, Australia's a wealthy economy. We're only putting in about 0.3% of our GDP into childcare services. The UK puts in 1%. We can afford to really invest heavily in children's services, in high-quality children's services across the board.
We're going to need to get you back, I think, because there's more to this than meets the eye. Mm. So thank you very much for making the time, though, to connect with us on this particular announcement. We'll follow up again with you, Elizabeth. Thank you.
No problem, Natasha.
Dr. Elizabeth Hill, she is a political economist at the University of Sydney and co-convener of the Work and Family Policy Roundtable, who have been tracking the childcare arrangements in Australia, paid parental leave and beyond, for many, many years now. Natasha Mitchell with you here on ABC RN. Who gives a crap? Simon Griffiths does. Coming up. On Friday, we looked at allegations of slave-like conditions for migrant workers employed within some of the fruit and veg supply chains of Australia's major supermarkets. And you can catch up with that story on the website. Is making a profit at odds with doing right by your fellow humans? Social enterprises make money, they make profits through business, but they channel their profits into making a difference socially. And it's not just what they do, it's the way social enterprises do it. Do business that is creative, and they have a lot to offer all workplaces. Last year, we caught up with Simon Griffiths. He's the founder of two social enterprises, a bar called, I think it's She Bean, and a company which manufactures and sells loo paper, aptly named Who Gives a Crap? And he was one of the speakers on a panel at the Future of Work conference recently, run by Melbourne Uni's Centre for Workplace Leadership. The session was called Innovate or Die, and we were interested to hear some of the lessons he was sharing with the audience at the conference. Simon Griffith, thanks for joining us in the Melbourne studios.
Thanks, Natasha. It's great to be here.
Where is Who Gives a Crap at? Just remind us how profits are being used from selling dunny paper, basically.
Yeah, so we sell an environmentally friendly toilet paper product, and we use half of our profits to build toilets in the developing world. So we're just coming up to a 2-year anniversary from when we started consistently selling toilet paper online primarily, and now we're in a whole bunch of different grocers, primarily in Victoria, where we're in most of the IGAs across the state with our six-pack product as well.
What impact have you had in those 2 years, that wonderful ceremonial start to your business, which was a crowdfunder with you sitting on a loo for, I think it was 51 hours or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, so we needed $50,000 to get a product off the ground, basically, and I said that I'd sit on a toilet on a live web feed until we crowdfunded that first, or pre-sold the first $50,000 of products. And yeah, it took 50 incredibly painful, horrible hours, which I'd rather not remember, but was quite a unique and memorable way, I guess, to get started.
But what have you actually been able to provide? What communities?
So we made our first donation to WaterAid, who are a beneficiary that we work with, shortly kind of after launching, I guess, and we sat down with them and looked at the amount that we were donating and the amount of product that we'd sold. And we worked out that basically every roll that we were selling was providing someone with access to a toilet for a week. Now, about 18 months down the track, so in January this year, we sat down and looked at retrospectively everything that that we'd done to date and what our donations looked like moving forward. And we worked out that at that point in time, so 18 months in, we'd provided about 46,500 people with access to a toilet. It's been quite impactful.
It's working.
Yeah, it's really working.
So this session, Innovate or Die, interested us. And you're a lean operation by the sounds. I think is it you and five other staff?
Yeah, me and four other full-time staff, and then we've got, directors who are, spending a few hours here and there or more if needed as well.
In what ways do you, Simon, think you've had to think about how you do your business differently to a traditional business selling products like yours?
So I think, toilet paper is probably the most stale product category that exists in the world.
It's so vital.
Yeah, so I guess what we wanted to do was come at it from a very different angle. So when you look at traditional products, they're all sold through the supermarket, which is a very hard market to gain entry into. And all of the marketing around them is pretty much based on puppies, pillows and feathers. So we wanted to, I guess, stir things up a little bit by creating a pretty fun brand. So maybe the Ben & Jerry's of toilet paper. And all of our marketing kind of stepping away from those things that are traditionally used to you know, pull sales triggers, I guess. So all of our marketing is always quite tongue-in-cheek and you know, really approaching it from a different angle to what you traditionally see on the supermarket shelves.
Much more than marketing, though. It's the very nature of your operation. And yes, online businesses are not novel anymore and many people run them. But just describe the setup.
Yeah, so, I mean, the interesting thing about toilet paper in particular is that basically before we came along, there wasn't an opportunity to buy it online. It was all sold through bricks and mortar businesses. Mm. But it's a pretty annoying product to buy because it's so bulky, especially if you're living in the inner city. You've got to lug this toilet paper home under your arm. So we worked out there was an opportunity to sell toilet paper in bulk through an online setup with warehousing across Australia. And we now warehouse in 5 states and territories, which allows us to have pretty much next day delivery to about 70% of Australians. And we sell in 24 and 48 roll packs with individually wrapped rolls, which are put into quite fun, unique, well-designed wrappers. And then we have 3 emergency rolls in the bottom of every box, so you know when you're about to run out. And we also set up a subscription service, so you can sign up for a regular toilet paper delivery. We'll email you before each delivery to check if you're ready. And if you're not, we'll delay it by a set number of weeks based on what your usage patterns look like. And we get you set up so that you will never, ever run out of toilet paper again.
People think to stay lean as a business that you have to take shortcuts, and that staff are often overworked in small businesses. We know that. Someone is always going to be shortchanged along the way. What about the way in which you work as a team?
Yeah, well, I mean, we kind of, you know, I think there's kind of 2 definitions of lean, and one is that that definition of being frugal, I guess, in some ways. The approach that we take with lean is really about testing things in very small increments and seeing if they're working. And if they are working, then expanding them out. And if they're not, looking at why that's happening, what we can learn from that, and then changing what we're doing to be more successful moving forward. So we're constantly, we call it, you know, I guess, faking it till you make it. So failing very quickly and cheaply over and over again until you're eventually successful. That's really how we approach lean. And it means that there's, you know, quite a fun sort of work culture, because we'll try almost anything to see what happens and then use the learnings from that to help us build out what we're doing moving forward.
It's one of the sort of mantras of innovation, isn't it? Fail fast, yeah, and fail often.
Totally. But we've got quite a unique setup. So we have, as we said before, 5 employees, but no one works regular office hours. And although 2 of us live in Melbourne, we haven't actually been in the same office space for over a month at the moment, because we can all work remotely using, you know, really great technology to help us remain efficient and be able to carry out the tasks that we need to from wherever we are.
How interesting. So you really are working flexibly. Are you able to take home a full-time wage?
Yeah, totally. So all of our staff are really well remunerated, which is fantastic. And for me, it was actually the first wage that I'd had since about 2005. So when I finally started drawing that wage about 12 months ago, it was a pretty big victory.
What were you living on in the meantime?
Well, you know, starting businesses
generous
in Australia.
Generous benefactors.
No, not really.
Mum and dad.
No, not that either.
Partner.
So I used to tutor finance and economics at the University of Melbourne for about 5 years, and that really kind of paid my way. And then when I was eventually able to step away from that, I was doing a lot of kind of paid public speaking work, and then finally transitioning into a full-time wage with Who Gives a Crap, which has been fantastic.
Because you do have an interesting career trajectory. You're an engineer and an economist by training. You could have hurtled well into the corporate world, and you were on your way to doing that.
Yeah, I was one of those kids that was really entrepreneurial at school, and then got in trouble quite a bit, and I guess got to university and realized that I could actually achieve things, and I was, you know, relatively smart. And so I kind of, you know, focused on university and did really well, and then kind of got pushed into, I had sort of that entrepreneurial spirit almost beaten out of me through that, you know, kind of more traditional career trajectory into a corporate job. and started there and realized that it wasn't quite right, and then took some time to kind of find that entrepreneurial spirit again, and ending up, I guess, somewhere in between the, you know, the for-profit world and the non-profit world, doing something that is all about business, but using business to create social outcomes that I'm truly, you know, passionate about.
We haven't got to the bar business yet, and we might not, but I'm interested, you sell online the loo paper, but it's manufactured in China, and therein lies another tension. I mean, China may well be the manufacturing hub of the world now, but what about the conditions for the workers who are making your toilet paper to supply a social enterprise that is touted to be ethical?
Yes, that was a big consideration for us. And we kind of wrestled with it for a while, and we looked at domestic production, and a few things kind of stuck out of us, one of which was this made in Australia issue, where things that are made in Australia aren't necessarily made from materials that come from Australia. So there's a lot of labour issues that you can't get transparency on necessarily without, you know, doing a pretty incredible trace back of your supply chain. And you don't control that supply chain if you're using a third party producer in Australia. The other piece was the price issue. And when we talked to Australian producers, they told us that we basically couldn't do what we were trying to do by producing in Australia. We had to look for overseas production, and that's what sort of led us overseas. But we did spend a lot of time looking at different production facilities, understanding what, you know, the ethical ramifications of each of those were, and then working out how we could work with the production facility that we were happy with from an ethical perspective. And this is something that we'll continue working on moving forward, because we firmly believe that made in China is not going away, and it's about figuring out how to make made in China better for everyone that's involved, consumers as well as the producers and their staff.
Why don't you manufacture here? Or indeed the countries that are beneficiaries of your products, of beneficiary of your profits?
Well, so where we produce at the moment, we are in quite a small production facility where a lot of the staff literally wouldn't have jobs if we were not doing the production ourselves. And these are people that, you know, rely on that wage to then put their families through school. So China still is a developing nation, even though there's incredibly, you know, big wealth divides, and you do have some incredibly wealthy people there. You've also got people that are living in pretty dire circumstances as well. So what we're doing by producing there is actually providing jobs to people that, if we were producing in Australia, those same jobs would be done by a machine, and we wouldn't have the benefits of the additional benefits of the labour that we're able to create jobs for. So we're really kind of proud of what we do there, and have worked really hard to make sure that the ethics of it all stack up, and we're happy with them, and we'll continue improving on that moving forward.
Well, we haven't even got to the bar business that you run, and that's an interesting one too. All sorts of interesting tensions there, selling alcohol from developing countries in a Melbourne bar. Some would say a disconnect.
Yeah, I think, Shebeen, so the idea is that we're a non-profit bar and we sell different beers and wines from all over the developing world, with the proceeds from each sale going back to an organisation in that drink's country of origin. So if you have one of our Ethiopian beers, you're helping to provide agricultural equipment to a rural farmer in Ethiopia. And there certainly is that tension there. And for us, that's kind of what's exciting about the idea, because if we can show people that you can use a product that's generally perceived to not be beneficial to society to do something that is positive, it starts getting people thinking about what else can be done. Yeah. You know, if you can do this with alcohol, what else can you do it with? And as a consumer, if I can choose to go to a bar and make a difference, what other decisions can I make that will be more beneficial for everyone else as well?
Simon Griff, it's really interesting to catch up with you again. Thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Simon Griffiths, he's CEO of Who Gives a Crap and a Melbourne bar, Shebeen Social Enterprises, and he was a speaker at the recent Future of Work conference in Melbourne. Well, look, thank you for your company today. Always great to join you at this time. And next on the program, well, surviving first year university. Are you there right now, or are your kids? Do they want to drop out? Are they really questioning their decision? We're going to look at that. It's a big dropout year. And the latest on alternative fuels. Yep, very interested in that one. Coming up to the news now on RN. Thanks for your company.